Our new experiment is our first experiment, our first introduction to a mechanism involving alkenes. And more specifically, this is going to be a type of electrophilic addition. So we had just had our review of what electrophile versus nucleophile means. So electrophile, that's a compound, a molecule that likes to gain electrons. And let's talk about why is it that alkenes can undergo these types of reactions. So first, a comment I made about alkanes in class. Talked about how alkanes generally aren't that reactive because there's no good bits of polarity for other molecules to be attracted to. Yes? This is lab lecture. So alkanes, not terribly reactive. That's why we make, or that's why we saw last week we could make alkyl halides out of them, so we have something that does have a bit more reactivity. But alkenes, which may contain just carbon and hydrogen, like alkanes only contain carbon and hydrogen, they're much more reactive. Why do you guess it is that alkenes are reactive in a way that alkanes aren't? Okay, because of the pi bond, which one explanation might be that, well, a pi bond is weaker than a sigma bond, and so maybe it's easier to break. That's part of the reason. But another part of the reason is that if you think of a sigma bond, those electrons are located between the two nuclei. In a pi bond, they're located above and below that axis between the nucleus, and so the electrons are a bit more accessible as well. So a combination of the bond itself being somewhat weaker, but also just the geometry of the bond is different, then that's why alkenes can be reactive, even though, again, you only have carbon and hydrogen. And so they're not terribly polar molecules. What I'm going to show you for a mechanism is a very general mechanism for the easiest case, the easiest example of electrophilic addition. This mechanism is not the one for today's lab, but I'm going to bring up some issues that we're going to discuss once we reach alkenes. And these same issues apply when we do examine the real mechanism that's going on today. This is going to be a little bit strange lecture then, because I'm going to give you some intro to the reactivity of alkenes, but I'm not going to go very in-depth yet, just because next week, once we've finished off SN1, SN2, we'll have plenty of time to talk more about alkenes. So I'm just going to show you an introductory mechanism to discuss in general about electrophilic additions. Then I'll come back to talking about the mechanism for today's reaction, and then I'll cover how to do the reaction. So first, the general example. Let's say that I have something like but1-ene, which, by the way, at this point, you now need to be responsible for alkene nomenclature. So I know for the exam last week I had said no alkene nomenclature, but we did cover some alkene nomenclature when we did the dehydration lab, and we will, of course, be revisiting nomenclature because we need to still finish discussing how do you know something's E versus Z in a doubly bonded compound. But we have but1-ene. That could react with an acid catalyst and something like an alcohol. The acid catalyst itself, H plus itself, is an electrophile. So what happens is the double bond opens up and connects with the hydrogen. That's going to form a new carbon-hydrogen bond. When that occurs, the hydrogen's not going to be split between two atoms. The bond's just going to be connected to one or the other of the two carbons. So what will happen is the double bond forms that new bond with the hydrogen, but the other carbon ends up with a carbocation. So which possibility do you think is more likely? That the bond's going to open up where the hydrogen ends up on the primary carbon and the carbocation ends up on the secondary position? Or do you think it's more likely to happen the other way around, where the carbocation ends up on the primary position, the hydrogen goes, on the secondary carbon. The secondary carbocation is more favorable, which means the hydrogen is going to end up like this. That's correct. Why? Because given that we have the same starting point, the same point of energetic comparison, if we make a secondary carbocation, that's energetically more favorable than making a primary carbocation. So given that both possibilities could occur, it's still going to be the secondary that's much more likely to happen because that's the more stable carbocation. Later on, we're going to learn this tendency, this regiochemical tendency is called Markovnikov addition, whenever you make a more stable carbocation. Now again, I'm not writing that down on purpose at the moment because we're going to have a whole lecture on it. But this is the most likely intermediate to form. Let's say that we had an alcohol in solution at this point. Then this kind of step maybe you've seen before, where you have oxygen attacking the carbocation. Now, how many different intermediates are we going to form just in this one step? Two. Why? So after you connect the what? I'm sorry? Okay, so the oxygen will leave, and that's another step. But even before the hydrogen leaves, you're correct, that does happen. But even immediately after the oxygen attacks, we're going to have two products. Why? That's right. This is a planar intermediate. It's sp2 hybridized. And this one aspect is very similar to what we're going to talk about on Wednesday, the SN1 reaction. Same thing there. Because you formed a carbocation, you can have attack occur from either side. That does matter in this case. Because of this particular example, you'd end up making a stereocenter. So you do get the two unique types of products. Now let me just make a comment about mechanism before, and I know I haven't finished this up quite yet. But you will be getting your lab quizzes back today. And the one question I was most concerned about was mechanism. Because I guess you all did get the warning that past sections hadn't done well because they put off studying. So I don't know what you all did, but most of you did really well on the theory questions as a class. But the one question as a class that you didn't do as well on is writing out the one mechanism that I had asked for. Now, I recognize that in lecture, we haven't had a lot of mechanisms yet. Now we're starting to. But from this point onward, then, anything that we learn, nearly every reaction that we learn is going to have a mechanism associated with it. And just like here, knowing that this is going to be a mechanism that generates a carbocation, we already know from past experience that that means that two products might potentially result. So if you know the mechanism, you can then make arguments about stereochemistry. Or, you know, I skipped over this point because it doesn't matter for this specific example, but because we have a carbocation, what regiochemical consequence could there be for this reaction? Hydride shift. Hydride shifts can and will occur in this kind of reaction. Now, for this specific example, it doesn't matter because it's not going to want to move from a secondary to a primary position. That kind of shift's not favorable. And if I went from secondary to this other secondary, they're chemically equivalent carbons. So So you just get the same intermediate back again. So the fact that a hydride shift is possible didn't matter for this specific reaction. But knowing that you make a carbocation, you need to start being able to recognize that means carbocation shift's going to occur. So the whole reason to tell that long story is, if you're weak with mechanism, fix the problem now. Either ask me during lab, ask me during lecture, ask me during office hours, get help learning mechanism. Because that's what distinguishes this course from OCHEM taught 50 years ago. 50 years ago, they might have known what mechanism was, and it was starting to be discussed, but it hadn't really hit textbooks yet. One of the big textbooks that came out at the time was so revolutionary because it took a mechanism approach. Before that, it was a lot of, well, here's a reaction, memorize the results. Well, here's a reaction, memorize the results. Well, here's a reaction, memorize the results. And not a lot of unifying, there wasn't this mechanism to understand why these things are going on. Yeah.
So far, all I've really meant is you memorize the mechanism.
Okay. And at first, that's okay, especially since we don't have a lot of mechanisms yet. As you start to memorize the mechanisms and start to write them out, you practice the mechanisms, then you'll start seeing common themes. Like every time that oxygen started out neutral and attacked something, no matter what reaction it's in, we've seen oxygen become positively charged as a result. And so that common theme, you're going to start recognizing. So even if you're memorizing mechanisms, you're just memorizing at some point the sequence of steps, not so much why is this happening, why is this. That you'll just start to understand. But if you don't have the mechanism, then you can't get to regiochemistry and stereochemistry, which are some of these things we're going to be talking about. So the first thing you do in any reaction's got to be learn that mechanism by heart. So again, coming back to what we've done so far, I have this alkene that I said, because of the fact that the electrons in that alkene are not being held directly between the atoms, those electrons more easily react. They'll react with something that really wants electrons, like H+, something that's a strong electrophile. Once that reacts, though, you form a carbocation at one or the other of the carbons of that double bond. In this example, we said the secondary is going to be more favorable because that is the more stable carbocation. Once the carbocation's there, if you have something like an alcohol as your reagent, it's able to attack at this point. And then there's just one last step that involves deprotonation of what used to be the alcohol. So it's actually a very simple mechanism if you step back at it. It's only 1, 2, 3 steps long. But there's a whole lot to talk about in there. But notice that, again, some of the things we're talking about are things we've talked about before. We've already talked about carbocation migration and the fact that carbocations are planar. So yes, do memorize the mechanisms, but then once you've done so, start trying to see the pattern. It'll make your job in the long term much easier. Yes? Do I not write the H+? Some people do, and some texts make you worry about what's taking the hydrogen off. My approach is that is so acidic that who cares what's taking the proton off? What's to say the proton doesn't just fall off on its own? Maybe it will get grabbed by something else in solution, but will it be grabbed by another alkene? Like, could that be the compound that starts the reaction with the alkene itself? Could an alcohol be grabbing that proton and it's just bouncing between oxygens? Could there be something else in solution? So rather than getting bogged down and worrying too much about it, the reason I don't show any detail is in this case it doesn't matter. Now, some textbooks don't like doing that, and for less experienced students, the fact that I don't say plus H+ in the products, you're thinking, wait, you're supposed to balance, which that's a good instinct. But if I take shortcuts, it's because I'm focusing on the substrate. Now, this is not the mechanism for this reaction. This is one class of mechanisms. And you'll actually see four or five reactions that all look identical to this. H plus in water is another variation, identical to this mechanism. Instead of an alcohol, you just have water. HBr, once the H plus and HBr gets attacked, the Br itself can be the thing that comes in and attacks instead of an alcohol or water. So very similar mechanisms. There's another class of mechanisms that all have a very specific intermediate. And that's what today's reaction falls into, this other class of mechanisms. Let me show it to you. First, that bit of terminology that came up in lecture today. When benzene is itself a substituent to something, it ends up being called phenyl pH, not F, the plant, but phenyl. Reason I'm bringing this up is, what is the name of the starting reagent for today's experiment? E stilbene, which is a common name for having a double bond with two phenyl groups on it. E meaning the same as trans. In fact, let me put this back on you. If I wanted to describe what E meant, how would you say it? Or the simpler one, how would you say what trans is? What's opposite? Be specific. So I think I know what you're visualizing in your head. We had this discussion about calling two sides of the double bond versus the two faces of the double bond. So using that terminology, how would you express what trans is? Someone want to help him out? You said opposite, which is correct. What's opposite? So you have the phenyl groups on opposite faces on opposite sides. So you look at one carbon versus the other carbon. You look and see which way the substituents are pointing. If they're pointing the same face on both sides, that's cis. If they're pointing the opposite face on both sides, it's trans. Since we only have one substituent on either side, we could use trans and cis, but the more systematic approach is to use E and Z, which in a case like this, trans is the same thing as E. That means, though, that we can name this compound E, 1,2-diphenylethene. Now notice I didn't call it F1-ene, because just like ethanol, where you only have two carbons to begin with, and there's no such thing as ethane-2-all, because that would be misnumbering the compound. You always try to give the lowest number possible. Same thing here. There is no such thing as F2-ene, because it would be F1-ene in real life. Because of that, you don't need the number. This undergoes a reaction with molecular bromine, Br2. double bond attacks the bromine, and as a result, the bromine-bromine bond is going to break. Now, can any of you think of a reason why bromine would want to undergo this reaction? What makes bromine an electrophile? Why, in general, would Br2 want to get electrons? Because that's what's happening in this case. What is the oxidation state of bromine when it's molecular bromine? Zero, right? Because all elements in their natural states, unreacted states, by definition, have an oxidation state of zero. If it's an element, it hasn't lost or gained electrons, which is why it has an oxidation state of zero. But what would we have as one of the products? The bromide ion, wouldn't we? What's the oxidation state of the bromide ion? -1. So this is a redox reaction. In this case, bromine is effectively getting reduced because of the reaction with the alkene. So you're going from oxidation state 0 to an oxidation state of -1, which is favorable for bromine. So in this reaction, if you hadn't picked up the clue yet, if I'm going through the effort to talk about oxidation states, then that means, yes, I expect that you know what I'm talking about. In this reaction, Br2 with oxidation state 0 is converted into Br minus, which is oxidation state of -1. Which is favorable. So all the halogens want to do this. Chlorine gas turns into chloride minus. Throw it at sodium metal. It really wants to get rid of electrons, and that's how we make sodium chloride, or if we wanted to make sodium chloride. F2, super duper electrophile, because it wants to get electrons from anywhere for fluorine to be F minus. Bromine, though, is a bit unusual, because bromine is a big ion. You know, we just talked about polarizability, and it's kind of good that we had that term, because now I could say something like this. Imagine bromine is so big and squishy that it doesn't just attach itself to one carbon. What if it somehow bridges what used to be the pi bond, where the bromine ends up just connecting both of those carbons? That's what's thought to occur in this mechanism, and that's why it's significantly different than the mechanism that we saw before. So what we'll get is the following. Now, before I can write this down, and again, I know that I might lose some of you here because I'm showing you lots of new concepts, but stilbene is a planar molecule, isn't it? Because we have the benzene ring, which is flat. Everything is sp2 hybridized. The double bond itself is sp2 hybridized, so flat. Both sides of the, both benzene rings are flat, so you have flat connected to flat connected to flat. So the molecule's flat. Well, that means when bromine is attacked, it's going to sit down on the top of the molecule, the top face, or the bottom face of that molecule. But as soon as it does, what is the hybridization of the carbon that used to be in the double bond become? So it starts out sp2, starts out a double bond, but I make a new bond with bromine. What hybridization does it become? sp3. If it's sp3, it's tetrahedral, it's not flat anymore. So how do we write it? So does not totally confuse us. Follow along with me just for a moment. So I'm going to take this molecule and take this flat molecule, and watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the whole screen and tilt it forward like this, so that the molecule is floating above the ground, parallel to the ground. Bromine's going to end up on top or the bottom, and the carbon-carbon bond, that alkene, I'm going to leave in the plane of space, you could say. So we'll have bromine that's straight up and down, and we'll have that carbon-carbon bond that's also straight up and down. So those are the two things I'm going to use plane lines for when I draw the structure down. But for a tetrahedral center, you can only have two plane lines, and otherwise you have to have a dash and a wedge, correct? So here's the way we're going to visualize it. If we're going to take this and turn it so that, let's say we do it this way, so that this benzene ring is pointed out at you, then once it reacts and gets pushed down by a bromine reacting above, we're going to write it with a wedge because it's pointed out at you. And the one back here that's pointed away, we're going to write that as a dash. And so here's what results. Again, here's one case in which the bromine ends up on top. Here's the other case where bromine ends up on the bottom. So one of the phenyl groups would end up pointed at us in both of these cases. And one of the other phenyl group would be pointed in the opposite direction because it started out the reaction trans. Now this kind of intermediate has the initially scary sounding name, cyclobromonium ion. And again, some of these details I'm going to mention verbally. We're not going to discuss much yet, but we're going to certainly come back to it in lecture. So cyclobromonium, cyclo meaning cyclic, bromonium meaning positively charged bromine. Think of ammonium, positively charged ammonium, ammonia. So the EM ending means positive. But it's a bromonium, not a carbonium, a carbocation. It's not a carbocation. Why does that matter? Well, if we don't have a carbocation, we don't have carbocation migration. And so the regiochemistry of this reaction is going to be something quite different. There's also very specific stereochemistry to this reaction. Because now what happens next is the bromine ion opens up. One of the two bonds does break. Yes? Neither cis nor trans. If you wanted to use that terminology, you'd say both are trans, but they're mirror images of each other. And that's because that starting alkene, the bromine could have sat down on the top or the bottom, giving us two different products. But because it's not a carbocation, we don't end up with regiochemical changes. And now, when one or the other of these bromine bonds breaks, it does so at the same time that something else comes in to kick the ring open. So that little part of the mechanism is kind of like SN2. And let me write one example of that. So step above, we made Br minus. Br minus can turn around and attack this intermediate. When it does, notice it does it at the same time that the bromine ring opens. That means that the bromines, the two of them, are added on opposite faces of the double bond. So bromine, the original bromine sits on one face of the double bond. The other bromine comes around from the other side and attacks. That's known as anti-addition. We're going to later have syn-addition. Remember these terms syn and anti from your Rotemer diagrams? Syn means the same side. So we're going to learn other reactions where relative to the alkene that you started with, both the groups end up on the same face. And so just to take this one example molecule that I attacked, let me show you the product that we get. We'll get that product plus the enantiomer that comes from the other molecule. Now, if that wasn't enough to follow, then there's the fact that this reaction doesn't go even according to this mechanism, not totally, because there's something special about the carbocation that could form if that ring opened by itself. And to get at that point, let me ask you this question. Regardless of what R is, there's a name for the position that I wrote this carbocation just now. And that name you might remember if you can think back to the list of alkyl halides that you used when you did the SN1, SN2 lab. So when you have something substituted at the position one away from a benzene ring, does anybody remember what that position is called? Benzyl. We're going to discuss in lecture Wednesday, why benzyl carbocations are special, why we care about those for SN1 reactions. But let me put this out there. A benzyl carbocation can form even if R is hydrogen, even if it's a primary carbocation. Primary carbocations are not supposed to form, are they? Because what do primary carbocations lack? Hyperconjugation. But what would this carbocation have that most primary carbocations don't? It's not even hyperconjugation, it's a massive amount of conjugation. Why? That carbocation, what is its hybridization? sp2. Every carbon on the benzene ring, what is its hybridization? Also sp2. So if we were to draw just a frame of the molecule where we don't show our sp2 or sp3 orbitals, but if instead we just drew out all the different p orbitals, well, one thing that we're going to learn next quarter is benzene is unusually reactive because every position on the benzene ring is conjugated with every other position. This is a special form of conjugation called aromaticity. So saying something is aromatic is saying that something is heavily delocalized. But look what we got right next door. That carbocation also has a p orbital, which can then become conjugated with the benzene ring. So even though you don't have hyperconjugation, you got something better. You've got conjugation that only happens if you made that carbocation. And so the carbocation forms much more easily than normal. Why am I saying this? Well, if you read the theory part of the experiment for today, the theory part was itself only a paragraph long, wasn't it? And it shows this mechanism and it makes the following comment, that because these types of benzyl carbocations are favorable, that instead of bromide coming in and simultaneously kicking open the ring, what if the ring could open all by itself? If it did, then the stereochemistry of one half of the molecule would be preserved. But the other half of the molecule would now be planar again. If you imagine that this ring opens and closes and opens and closes and opens and closes, that means that overall there's going to be a 50-50 chance, in some senses, that the carbocation can be attacked from either direction, regardless of what initially was formed. So that means we're going to end up with four different products, or at least on paper we will. But let's draw those four products out to see if really we're going to get four different products. Now, if I haven't confused you enough, let me try harder. Because to better show the relative directions of the bromines, I'm going to twist the molecule around in a rotamer, and I'm going to put the two benzene rings in the same plane, okay? And again, this reaction we're going to cover in lecture. So if you're finding yourself saying, wait, why does that happen? How did that happen? What the hell are you saying? Just remember, you got a whole nother chance to hear the story again. Wow, that was my South just coming through. You realize I just created a word that doesn't exist. A whole nother story. You can't take the word another and split it like that, right? Another. Anyways. Oh. That's right. I just remembered something else about benzene I have to show you in a minute. So the four possible products. So what if we imagine that on the left-hand carbon, bromine was pointed towards us? Well, then there's two possibilities from that. The other position also has the bromine pointed towards us, or it has it pointed away. We can reverse those possibilities. So we could say that the first position, the left-hand position, is pointed away from us. And then again, we can examine the cases of the other halogen being pointed towards or away from us. Now, the way that I've written these on paper, the top two molecules, what's the relationship between the two of them? Diastereomer, because you have two stereocenters, but you've only changed one of them. That would be the same relationship we have with the bottom two molecules. What about the left two molecules? They're also just diastereomers, aren't they? Because you're only changing one stereocenter. Now, what about the bottom left and the upper right possibilities? What's the relationship between the two of them? They're enantiomers because their stereocenters, all the wedges go to dashes, the dashes go to wedges, so they're enantiomers. What about the upper left and the lower right? What? The same molecule. Why? They're not enantiomers. Look at them. They're meso. Meso means it's self-reflecting in the middle. There's a mirror plane. So it's not actually that they're the two different molecules. You don't call the two molecules meso, there's only one molecule, and I've just happened to written it in two different ways. So, I'm going to form an optically inactive mixture. Why? Because I make three products. But one of the products is meso, the other two are formed as enantiomers, 50-50 mixed with each other. So you wouldn't make an optically active mixture. So, this is the mechanism. Let's go ahead and focus, though, on how you're going to do this reaction. So first, there's the warning message about bromine, which hopefully everybody's got that now. But you measure out bromine in your original starting material and just stir it, right? And the product magically forms and drops out of solution because the product happens not to be soluble in the solvent that you're using. You're then going to collect those crystals and wash them, correct? Now, a little bit of terminology that came up, and I forget how this came up this morning, but CH3, we have the word methyl that goes along with that. Even if it's not a methyl substituent, like if I looked at the starting reaction that we began with today, I could point at the end of the molecule and say that methyl group, meaning that carbon with three hydrogens on it. There's a shorthand term that means a CH2 group in the middle of the molecule. That has the short name methylene. Which actually comes from a systematic way of handling something that's got two connections. We won't see this form of naming, I don't think, this year. But that's where this comes from, this methylene. We'll put two chlorines of methylene, and that's how we get methylene chloride, the solvent that you're going to be doing the washes with. Now, a comment about those washes, because a couple of people this morning started asking me, is this white enough? Is this clear enough? Because you're supposed to wash the crystals until they're white or clear, right? Why is it that anytime we get one of these directions, all of a sudden everybody forgets what the color white is or what clear is? And has to ask me, basically, is this what I'm seeing white or not? What you're really asking, though, is have I done this washing enough? And that you really need to use your own judgment. And I'll make some comments on this. One, just a little bit of bromine can discolor your crystals. But if you use too much methylene chloride to wash the impurities away, then you might be dissolving some of your product away. On top of that, aren't you supposed to do a recrystallization? So does it make sense to waste a lot of solvent and possibly wash a lot of your product away if you're just going to be recrystallizing anyways? No. So use your own best judgment as far as how white is your set of crystals. If you think you've got it pretty washed out and you know you're going to do your recrystallization anyways, then don't put hundreds of milliliters of methylene chloride through your product just to clean it out. All right? So you do the reaction, crystals form all by itself. Very straightforward, easy reaction. You collect the crystals by vacuum filtration. You wash them with methylene chloride. You then are supposed to do a recrystallization. With what solvent? So it's pronounced xylenes. And it is with an S. It's a plural. Because the molecule xylene comes from benzene. Now, here's my very, very, very small amount of humor for today. And realize that this doesn't seem that funny, that this is chemistry, and it takes some work to make chemistry funny, right? And if you've heard this before, please don't say it so that the one or two people that actually laugh, I get that one or two laughs out. If that's benzene, what compound is that? Mercedes-benzene. Because think of the Mercedes logo, right? The symbol. You've got that in the middle of this ring. So Mercedes-benzene. That's about as good as it gets in chemistry. So that's, now you know what it's like to be on this side sometimes. All right. Then let me show you the next little bit. That xylene is actually one of three molecules. Xylene is when you put two methyl groups on benzene. But there could be three different orientations. One in which the two methyl groups are completely opposite each other, one in which they're right next to each other, and one where they're somewhere in between, where there's one carbon separating. These three different positions are called para, meta, and ortho. And so if you look these up in a text, you'll find p-xylene, m-xylene, o-xylene, para-xylene, meta-xylene, and ortho-xylene. Three very different compounds, three different sets of physical properties. But if we just care about xylene in general for its solubility, then xylenes is a mix of all three of them put together. Now, since I've shown you the para position, again, small amount of humor. This is a rather perplexing molecule. Can you figure out why? Well, first, what does the MD symbol mean? It's what some of you want to become someday, right? A doctor, medical doctor. So this is a paradox. A paradox, a puzzle. At least I got a reaction out of you. Chemistry reaction. Do we need to review what recrystallization is? How to do recrystallization? Well, it's been a few weeks since your lab quiz, so you might have flushed that part of your brain out already. So let's review it just in case. You're going to have your xylenes and your target compound side by side on a sand bath. You're warming both of them up, and you're going to be warming the xylene up to close to its boiling point of around 137 degrees. The boiling point doesn't really matter. Someone asked me this morning, and I still have it in my head, so that's why I'm quoting it. Point being, get it near the boiling point because you want to minimize how much xylene you use. Why? Because even at room temperature, some of your product might stay soluble in that xylene. So the more xylene you use, the more product you don't get back. So it decreases your yield. So you're going to add just a little bit of that hot xylene, little bit at a time, until barely at the point where your product dissolves. If you run out of time today to do this, if the clock is running out, then, if you hadn't quite gotten it all to dissolve, turn the heat off, stopper it up, and store it for next time. Next time, just reheat it and continue on. But once you do get it to completely dissolve, then you take it off of the sand bath, let it cool down to room temperature, crystals form, and you filter and dry those crystals. Those crystals, we will be doing IR, but I have to show you how to do solid IR. Which, given how far everybody got today, don't want to take any more time today to show you that. You're also going to be doing NMR, but not at first. Because how can I have you use the NMR machine if you haven't run a standard compound for me to know whether or not, or for you even to know, whether or not you can use the NMR machine? So one of the NMR machines I calibrated this morning, the other one I'll work on while you're working this afternoon. If you get to the point where you're done with your crystallization and you've got time left, you can start working on your NMR spectrum. And here's what everybody's going to do first. There's going to be one compound. We have a couple of reference compounds that we use to calibrate the machine. You'll do an NMR scan of just that reference compound. Again, that way you'll know whether you got the right results or not, whether you got a good spectrum or not. And in fact, I'll print out, I made a spectrum this morning, I'll print that out that you can use as a reference. After everybody's had the chance to take that reference spectrum, then you'll go back later and do an NMR scan for the compound that you're making today. So you need to keep the solid for at least a week or so until we can get through the NMR. You also do still have your samples from the previous experiment, which you're going to be doing GC with. But nobody got done enough today to be able to do GC with. So I probably won't turn on the GC today because it takes a while to ramp it up and ramp it back down again. But that's not really a problem. We're going to have time left to do it. And showing you how to use the GC will only take a few moments. But so for today, what you need to do is get your reaction done, at least filter out your crystals the first time. Start working on recrystallization. And again, if you get interrupted, if you run out of time, just store everything. Once you finish the recrystallization, if you have time left today, then don't do melting point. It says do melting point. We've already done one that's boring. We don't want to do another one. So once you've got your products, you can either work on NMR, or next time, if this is occurring, we'll also have GC for you to work on. Questions about anything from today's experiment? Then let's go ahead and get working.